right, welcome back to University of Minnesota Extension's Nutrient Management Podcast. I'm your host, Paul McDivitt, Communications Specialist here at U of M Extension. Today on the podcast, we're talking about fall fertilizer. We have three members of Extension's Nutrient Management Team, Dan Kaiser, Fabian Fernandez, and Brad Carlson. Can you each give us a quick introduction?
Hi, this is Daniel Kaiser. I'm a Nutrient Management Specialist with University of Minnesota Extension. I'm located on the St. Paul campus.
Fabian Fernandez, also located in the St. Paul campus. I'm a nutrient management specialist focused on nitrogen for corn cropping systems and the impact of fertilizers on water quality.
Brad Carlson, I'm an extension educator. I work out of our Mankato regional office, work more or less statewide, extensively on issues related to water quality, but also other nutrient management topics like precision ag and so forth.
All right, starting off, how early is too early when planning nitrogen applications?
It is too early right now. We are the first day of October today, and you know, we look at the temperatures. That's the main indicator. It's never really a good idea to look at the calendar day to decide when to apply nitrogen, and so. But, you know, for Minnesota conditions, we are really looking at, you know, sometime in November when the temperature starts to go below 50 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, 6 inches below the surface and staying at that or going cooler.
You know, one of the things we talk about a lot with in our area in southern Minnesota is kind of looking at that date, and we do not use a date as a recommendation. Although I know Jeff Vetch did some calculation a few years ago, and he found that the average date that we hit 50 degrees soil temperature is about the 25th of October. And they put that out a long time ago. And again, we don't use that as a, oh, go out on the 25th of October, but it's sort of a way of thinking about when is it getting close. So we're still about 3 weeks away from that. But the thing about that is of course, is I pay attention then, too, to that date as well as where the soil temperature is at that date or in the vicinity of that date, and it's been pretty close. And so in a lot of cases, I think if you're looking at making an application, you can think about that date, but then, of course, you have to stay in tune with what exactly the soil temperature is after that point. And the way I look at it is, well, you realize if it's too wet, you can't go out. Well, if it's too warm, you can't go out either. So it's just simply a weather-based situation.
Yeah, and we don't really know. I mean, you know, kind of, I guess this year, fortunately or unfortunately, the way things have been delayed, I mean, I think we're probably looking at pushing a few things back, particularly just with the being able to get into the field right now, as we're sitting here on the 1st of October, and I've seen a few soybean fields I know being harvested, but not too many. You know, Brad, I know southern Minnesota, I was just driving kind of, you know, southeast of the cities there, and I saw a few fields out, but I know we'll start to have some growers think about that. And you get these wet years, you know, kind of one of the things that worries me a little bit is just the grower attitude and in terms of waiting, because it's difficult. And you look at logistics, you look at the co-ops, you know, having to get us so much done, we just don't know what we're going to run into. And last year, you know, we kind of saw things start to get a little bit colder a little earlier than we expected. But we have seen years where we've seen warm-ups around that Thanksgiving time frame, and we still go out and do things. But that also means that there's also some risk for some nitrogen conversions. So it's, you know, one of the things, you know, kind of playing, I think, this game of trying to figure out what's the best thing to do, it becomes kind of a challenge, particularly the last few years when we've just had this up and down weather in the fall.
Yeah, and you know, in terms of the temperature, the magical number really is 32 degrees. That's where nitrification will stop, where bacterial activity will stop, and there will be no nitrification happening. But the 50 degree temperature that we always talk about is kind of a nice compromise between what we should do and what is okay to do, because obviously if you wait until 32, the soil is frozen, you cannot really do anything at that point. But 50 degree is kind of a sweet spot where bacterial activity is diminished sufficiently that you don't get as much conversion of ammonium to nitrate. And so that's why we talk about 50. So it's kind of trying to compromise minimizing the transformation of nitrogen and also still have time and conditions where we can actually do field work. And so, but it is a challenge, like Dan mentioned. You know, you look at the forecast and you see that it's going to be wet, and what do you do? It's always a challenge, but keep that in mind as you look at the temperatures and the weather, that 50 degrees, you know, you're still at a point where you can get nitrification going. And as Dan also mentioned, it's not unusual to see these warm-ups that happen, you know, late November, sometimes even in December, and some of that transformation continues to take place.
Yeah, and I think with, we talk about nitrogen, I mean, yeah, the 50 degrees, you know, with P and K, we don't necessarily have to worry too much about that temperature because we don't have that conversion. I mean, those forms that are there are already going to be the ones that are available. The main thing on those two, though, is really not delaying too late, because, you know, while it's better to wait with nitrogen, with phosphorus and potassium, I mean, really we want at least some interaction with the soil, because if we don't get that, what you're going to have is some very soluble forms of fertilizer sitting near the surface, and if that soil is near frozen, you get a runoff event that occurs, or some water movement off the site that fertilizer can solubilize and move off the site itself. So it's one of the things, you know, usually we see P and K going on earlier, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, although with the phosphorus sources, we end up getting a little nitrogen there where it becomes very difficult to predict availability at that point in time, because the earlier you go, the less likely that's going to be there because it should be converted. And so that's the main thing with it, you know, looking at those rules is make sure you know, or what we say, rules of thumb. I wouldn't necessarily say a rule. I mean, it's a rule of thumb that we say 50 degrees. Just know what you're looking at there in terms of the forms of nutrients and kind of how things need to be in place to make sure that they're there in spring and or in that early summer time frame when that crop's going to need it.
Yeah, it's also worth, and we've been talking a lot about the weather, and you bring that up, Dan. Most of that P and K growers are going to apply that and try and incorporate it, use a field cultivator or something like that. And of course, that tillage pass is going to be somewhat dependent on the weather, because no one's going to go out there when it's real muddy. So you do need to pay some attention to the weather forecast to realize that for instance, a harvested bean field is quite trafficable even when it's fairly wet. It's easy to go out and make a fertilizer application, but if you're not likely to be able to get that incorporated in a somewhat timely fashion, you are setting yourself up to a little bit of risk. We've been getting some pretty significant fall rainfalls. I mean, we wouldn't want that laying on the surface and then get 2 inches of rain before it got incorporated. Similarly, we don't want to be playing games with whether the soil is going to freeze and you're never going to get out there at all, because we definitely don't want fertilizer laying on frozen ground. That's just inviting trouble.
And I've had some interesting conversations with some colleagues, you know, from other states talking about this, particularly what Brad, what you said with the application to soybean stubble and, you know, what's the best option, because normally we get situations where we want to try to prevent erosion. With soybean stubble, it's really not the best idea, particularly on rolling ground, to go in and heavily till that that stubble. But
well, it's worth mentioning, we actually have tillage best management practices, and research has shown fall tillage of soybean stubble isn't even necessary. So in most cases, yeah, it's an incorporation of fertilizer.
But yeah, it's an incorporation, because if you don't do that, I mean, you look at soybean stubble versus corn stubble, you look at essentially impedance of that water flow across that field, that there is definitely more risk, particularly with P and K with surface applications. And we would want more gentle rainfall to try to get that to bind. One thing that we've seen is you give yourself 10, 15 days, you get a little bit of this reaction of that fertilizer with the soil. It tends to really reduce some of the runoff risk with that. But it's kind of that guessing game, because, yeah, it's been amazing what we've gotten for rainfall events in September and even October last few years.
And I would say, you know, for P and K, really looking at the forecast and making sure that you apply not ahead of a big storm. That's the key, because as Dan mentioned, I mean, there have been plenty of studies where looking especially at phosphorus runoff because of the environmental consequences of phosphorus getting into the water, that, you know, if it sits there in the soil for, you know, a week, 10 days, the potential for the runoff really gets minimized because it had time, that nutrient had time to interact with the soil. And so looking at the forecast, making sure that there won't be a torrential rain event happening right after application is probably the best thing to do. Another thing I want to mention, since we were talking about residue and going back a little bit to soil temperature, you know, you can go to in Minnesota, there is a website for soil temperatures where you can look at where it is. But soil temperature, of course, varies drastically depending on the conditions of your soil, the moisture content of the soil, the darkness of that soil, residue cover on that soil. All of those impact the temperature. And so the best way to really know what the temperature is on your particular soil is to take a temperature probe and just measure that temperature before you start doing nitrogen applications.
Yeah, and then too, we talked about P and K too, Fabian, and I think urea, we could make some of the same too in terms of, you know, how do we treat that with fall applications. I mean, urea itself is mobile, so we could have some of the same issues too. So, you know, it's really kind of, I think, trying to be a little more aware of, it's really hard, I think, to look at some of the extended forecasts anymore because you never really know. Just like, you know, just looking at predicting the weather, it's amazing to me and how watching news in the morning and you get weather four times and I get four different forecasts from the same person of what's going to happen there. But you really have to kind of be a little bit more aware of that with these, particularly these highly water soluble sources, because urea itself will move as well. So
yes, that is an important one. Yes, I mean, if you are in an area where urea is an okay practice for fall application, or for a spring application for that matter, urea does move as nitrate does until it converts. I mean, it converts quickly to ammonium, but it takes a couple of days. And so if you apply urea and then you get 2 inches of rain, that urea is going to move freely with the water.
Really, tillage, I mean, subsurface application, now Brad was mentioning that banding, I mean, really that really reduces your risk. So that's one of the main things that, you know, tillage is a BMP when it comes to fertilizer application. It's just whether or not you're increasing the risk for sediment loss. I mean, then it becomes some other issues that really, you know, it's a whole another topic, I think, for another day.
Are we looking at a year where farmers should consider inhibitors?
Well, you know, anything that we can do to minimize the nitrification process, it's useful, especially when you're applying fertilizer so early in relationship to when the crop will need it. And so if you look at the efficiency of a nitrification inhibitor, the fall is really the best time where you would get the most return on that investment, just simply because you have such a long window of opportunity for that nitrogen application to transform to nitrate and then be subject to loss if the conditions are such. And so, yes, I would say using a nitrification inhibitor is important. The other piece that sometimes gets confused is with inhibitors is a urease inhibitor. Sometimes people don't recognize that they are completely different things. A urease inhibitor does very little for you if you're incorporating your nitrogen source. And so it's really what we are most concerned about when we talk about inhibitors in the fall is a nitrification inhibitor.
It's worth mentioning that fall application of anhydrous ammonia with a nitrification inhibitor in south central Minnesota is a best management practice. We say acceptable with risk, but it's very important to point out that risk is just simply, will it pay for itself? There's no environmental risk for using a nitrification inhibitor. It will either produce good results or no results. It's not going to produce bad results. So the question is whether it paid for itself or not. And it's really kind of a sweet spot. Minnesota happens to be kind of in the crosshairs of where it tends to be most effective in terms of whether it's warm enough that you needed that to prevent the conversion of ammonium into nitrate versus whether it's too cold and it really doesn't experience that pressure, as well as, of course, if the we have too long of a window of time, it does wear off. And so it's kind of all these factors that kind of go into did it work as far as preventing loss of nitrogen and therefore pay for itself. And so when we talk about acceptable with risk, the way of kind of looking at it is like how many years out of five did it work? Was it necessary? Did you receive an economic payback? I look at the data from Waseca, and typically it's about 3 out of 5. So on average, it does pay for itself. But of course, the things that you need to realize is it won't every year. Some years it wasn't necessary at all. Just using straight anhydrous was the same. And there's other years where it already wore off and then you lost nitrogen anyway. And so, both of those things can occur.
And that's, I always remind people that nitrification inhibitors are not bulletproof. They help, but they wear off. And so using them is not an excuse. You use poor practices, agronomic practices, right? I mean, we would not apply anhydrous ammonia when the temperature is 60 degrees in the soil and say, well, I'm protected here because I apply an inhibitor. Well, the inhibitor will wear off faster with warmer temperatures. The breakdown of the inhibitor happens faster. And so you're basically having less potential for that inhibitor to be beneficial to you. So, again, trying to wait as long as you can until temperatures are cool. The cooler they are, the less nitrification you get, but also the more benefit you get from that inhibitor.
Yeah, if I went back in my career, back when I first started, we weren't seeing a large percentage of farmers using nitrification inhibitors. Primarily at that time, nitrogen was really cheap. I mean, we're like 8-10 cents a pound, something like that. And the prevailing thought was, well, I'll just buy more nitrogen and lose some. But of course, I think we recognize the environmental concerns now as an industry. We really can't have that mindset that I'm just going to apply more than I need, knowing I'm going to lose a bunch of it because of the weather conditions. And so realistically, you should be looking at applying the correct rate. And then if you think you have risk, you should be buying a nitrification inhibitor and not just simply buying more nitrogen so that you can lose it.
And one thing I guess I would kind of have too as a consumer, I would, farmers just to look a little bit more into if they are buying inhibitors. There's a lot of products out there that initially when they came on the market were claimed to be inhibitors. Now I think a lot of them, since they've seen no inhibition ability, have kind of termed themselves nitrogen additives or products. And it's one of the things to kind of look at the data a little bit more, because there's some cheap products out there that are cheap products that aren't really going to work. So even spending a couple bucks an acre on something that really seems cheap, you'd be better off saving your money, because you're really not doing anything or any good if it's not something that's been identified as an inhibitor. And we've got very good data, particularly with like the NSERF products, nitropyrin, not maybe as much, Fabian, with the Instinct product. I mean, it's certainly Instinct with manure has shown some benefits, maybe with banded urea a little bit better than broadcast urea. But we know those products are out there, DCD products. There's some newer ones on the market, I think, now for nitrification that have shown to help. It's that product, particularly DCD, has been more mobile, so that one's a little bit more problematic, particularly in the field, to kind of keep it around for longer. But other than that, I mean, there just really hasn't been anything else out there that's really, if you look at testing it in a lab setting to look at whether or not it can inhibit nitrification, that really works.
It's important to remember that what you're inhibiting is microbial activity in the soil. You're not affecting the fertilizer. And so from that respect, if you're looking at using the inhibitor, you realize that the more soil you're trying to affect, the less likely it is to be effective. So one of the issues, for instance, with Instinct on urea is that if you're doing a broadcast application, you're trying to affect all of the soil all the way across it. There's a lot of stuff to try and interact with versus, for instance, NSERV in an anhydrous band that's a concentrated small area where it has to impact versus all the way across the surface. And so, some of those things also are important to realize when purchasing these products and how you're going to use them.
Yeah, and we certainly are, you know, we are looking actually at the questions with urea. Obviously, urea is easier broadcast incorporated than doing a subsurface band with a dry product, but we're actually testing that. And in some situations, we've seen some benefit with the banding, and again, with the inhibitor. Not consistent, but if you are going to have a benefit, tends to be more certain when you're banding the fertilizer simply because of that concentration. You're putting a lot of more of that active ingredient in close proximity to the fertilizer that is in contact with less soil.
But still, we look at our BMPs, and that's one of the things that concerns me a little bit, particularly for retailers wanting to go away from anhydrous, is using urea with a product like Instinct and claiming that's just as good as anhydrous, particularly for a broadcast application, and going with that in areas where we don't recommend fall urea. And it's getting harder and harder in a lot of areas to recommend it just with the rainfall we're getting. So looking at it, I think when you really want growers, the kind of the end user, to start asking some questions in terms of management, because it's just not a time right now where you can invest a lot of extra money in things that aren't really gonna make you any money back. So it's just challenging. And we look at trying to cut costs a little bit. You look at some of these little costs that they tend to add up over time. So you really want to try to make sure that what you're doing is doing exactly what you want it to do, or at least has the potential to do that, versus just throwing your money out there.
Well, and if you really want to simplify that argument, Dan, I mean, even if people, if they don't want to believe us, or if they say, well, you know, my dealer told me it's fine, you do recognize that we as a university are saying it's not fine in a lot of places, a lot of situations. So do you want to go with practices where there's an argument about whether it's fine, or do you want to just choose practices where no one has an argument at all? And that's obviously a safe bet, particularly given the economics in agriculture.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, we could go on talking a little bit more about this, but there is no really time. But, you know, you look also at fall versus spring applications. That's another question, you know, in terms of safe bets of what works and what doesn't, or what works better. And, you know, I'm seeing more and more with the data that we are collecting that even a fall application with anhydrous ammonia, with an inhibitor, doing it correctly at the right time, everything typically tends to produce less yield, and you need more nitrogen than doing the same application in the spring.
Yeah, and I've done a lot of presentations over the last few years related to nitrates moving through drainage water. You know, one of the seminal studies we've got here in Minnesota, some of Giles Randall's work at Waseca with the drainage plots, they were finding that fall application of anhydrous with an inhibitor with NSERV, they were not losing any more nitrogen when they did the spring application. Okay, so environmentally they were equal practices, but the yield was reduced to an average of 8 bushels an acre when you did the fall application. And, you know, we pretty much ascribe that to the heavy textured soils, glacial soils in southern Minnesota, the clay loams, so forth. We're getting denitrification. It's not ending up in the tile water, but we are losing nitrogen. And so from that perspective, it did have an economic penalty. And I think, you know, one of the things that we need to think about, and Dan, you brought up the whole logistic issue, and of course we keep hearing this, well, we can't get it all put on in the spring. I'm somewhat questioning that now, because pretty much every dealer has the ability to apply in season. And so, you know, as long as we got some put on, you know, particularly like for corn on corn situations, and in some cases corn on beans, you really don't need to worry about whether you got it on or not, get it planted. I think we've got a whole lot more ability to be applying in the spring and into the growing season than we had 10 years ago. I'm not sure it's just as big of a concern as it was. In fact, realistically, when I talk to dealers, it's more of a logistics issue with their storage and their capacity than it is their ability to apply it.
Yeah. The big question, I think, that continues to be a driver is the cost, in terms of, you know, a fall price versus spring price. And that is one of the things that, you know, people obviously consider. But, yeah, I agree with what you're saying, Brad, that there are so many options right now for a spring application that is not any longer the issue of, well, if I don't apply it in the fall, then I'm really looking at that a big problem in the spring.
And all we have to do is look at last year where it got so wet that most of the application didn't happen at all. And, it, you know, obviously we had parts of the state that we had a lot of crop didn't get planted either. Of course, in those circumstances, it would have been wasted money if it had gotten too wet and you hadn't have been able to plant at all. But that being said, you know, the nitrogen did get on to the crop that got planted after we had a bad fall where we couldn't do a lot of applications. So it did happen.
And whether we like it or not, I think things are changing in terms of the weather and the weather we experience. I mean, I've been in Minnesota for 6 years, and I don't think we have had any growing season that was like a dry growing season or a dry spring. It has, all of them have been wet springs. And, you know, with applying nitrogen early, too early in the fall or too early in the spring, actually, that's one of the challenges, because we are seeing situations where you end up not having a crop in there, or having to maybe go for soybeans or something different simply because you could not get the, this year was a perfect example of that, where there were a lot of acres where you just had to simply make a change. And so if you don't have that investment already in the field, it makes that, you know, that decision a little bit easier.
We talked about this already a little bit about the economics, but what makes sense the most, what makes the most sense economically for all fertilizers, N, P, and K this fall?
Well, you know, we talk about P and K a little bit, and I think one of the things that, you know, I kind of stress is when you start looking at making your decisions is that, you know, use the best information you have. I mean, don't go out and just say, okay, I'm just going to put on what I took off, because you start looking at the overall cost of that. I think one of the things that hit home a few weeks back, we were at our staff development, we had one of the economists in talking a little bit about that, and talking about, you know, reducing costs across the board to maintain profitability. I think fertilizer is one of the ones that, you know, we're so ingrained that, particularly with phosphorus and potassium, of what it's done historically when we look at applications. And certainly you go back, it was go back 50 years when we were just really starting to get fertilizers in the market. A lot of things started looking at our soils were low, started to get a lot of high return on investment, where we started to see soil tests increase and start to build over time, that we get situations like this, you know, it might be a good time to start drawing things out of the bank. So looking at not maybe eliminating applications, but at least reducing it. And if you're looking at variable rate, I know, Brad, you've kind of, one of the things you've talked a little bit about has been, you know, how do you make variable rate pay with that? And I think that's where a lot of growers, I mean, you go in and just think, okay, well, you can just go and take my yield map and put on variable rate what I took off, and I'm just going to stick with that because that's going to make me money. And really, you got to start looking at it, I think, of trying to reduce on costs, because that's really where we're looking at, you know, really making your money back in variable rate.
Now, crop removal is a scheme. I mean, we've just shown that consistently through the decades that that's not a viable concept to be fertilizing a field with, that you can't just simply take, you know, how much PK and I guess nitrogen too went off in the grain, and I need to put that much back on. There's just too many dynamics in nature to do it that way. It just doesn't work out. And so, you know, we've talked about this, I think, in the past too, that I've looked at the data relative to our adult farm management program that looks at crop budgets, and the 20% most profitable farms in Minnesota spent 30% less on fertilizer per acre than the 20% least profitable farms. No other crop inputs have that kind of spread. There's obviously, you know, your most profitable farms typically do have lower costs than your least profitable farms. But like for seed and herbicide, it's only 10%. So why is it 30% on fertilizer? It's very clear that there's some people engaging in practices that just flat out don't return investment. And this crop removal strategy is one of them. You need to base fertility recommendations on soil test. And if you're in that very high range and above, skip it. It just doesn't need it.
And maintenance, you know, may not be the same thing as crop removal too. You know, I mean, you start looking at it, I mean, I've seen that consistently and across a number of our long-term trials, is in order to maintain soil tests, I could be applying downwards about 60% of crop removal and still maintain my 0 to 6 inch soil test. So if you've got the soil test, I mean, the main thing is to look at where you're at. And if you're in those very high categories, I mean, cut the rates back a little bit. You don't need to eliminate, but trim them back a little bit to the point at which it's you're not spending upwards of what may be for removal about 80 units P2O5. If you're dealing with the soil test over 30 part per million Bray, there's just no chance you're going to return that. In most cases, what we see in that circumstances is, you know, maybe seeing a small starter rate being ideal of about 20 pounds. So it's one of the things that really needs to be kind of looked at is if you're using variable rate, you got to identify those areas that are being grossly over-fertilized and try to make some money back on saving on costs. And then, you know, maybe you have a few areas that are under-fertilized that you can increase yield by additional fertilizer. But I think for the most part, the way a lot of these fields are is that as long as you have more acid soils and not real high pH soils that tend to fix phosphorus, that I think a lot of the fields are going to be in pretty good shape unless you've got a rented piece of ground that was mined out pretty heavily before you got that particular piece.
Yeah, and you know, we always think about P and K together, but the reality is that we don't have to apply both nutrients in every situation. And this goes back to my days when I was in Illinois. I actually did a survey of soil fertility across that state in Illinois. And it was very surprising to me to see a large percentage of fields that had really high phosphorus, that there was no need for phosphorus, that were in the deficient category for potassium. There were very few of the other kinds of fields where you had really high potassium and deficient phosphorus. And so I think typically people talk about phosphorus, you know, making sure that you have phosphorus, and then potassium typically kind of comes second. But in reality, looking at the soil test values to determine what you need to be applying, it may be that you apply a good amount of potassium and very little or no phosphorus. And that will be the most profitable thing that you can do instead of just applying, you know, the typical rate that you've been applying.
I'm not a hardcore soil chemist, but through all my experience in extension now, typically speaking, when we get to the southeastern part of the state, we have a lot of natively higher phosphorus levels and a lot less response to phosphorus. And then as we move to the northwest, it's higher levels of potassium. And so they do kind of flip-flop based on what you're dealing with soils. Obviously, if you're an individual farmer, you're just used to dealing with what you deal with on your own farm. You don't need to worry about it across the state. But it's worth noting that we do see those differences as we go, particularly from southeast to northwest in Minnesota, just based on what was put in place from the glaciers.
All right, that about does it for the podcast this week. We'd like to thank the Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council, AFRAC, for supporting this podcast. If you haven't already, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. You can also find out about new podcast episodes, as well as our blog posts and videos, by subscribing to Minnesota Crop News email alerts. Just Google Minnesota Crop News and click Get Minnesota Crop News by Email on the homepage. And be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at UMN Nutrient MGMT. Thanks for listening.